Welcome to another episode of 30 Minutes in the New Testament. 30 Minutes in the New Testament is a 1517 podcast, network podcast. You know what that means. You know that means you can go over to 1517.org/podcast and check out all of those casts. There's a bunch of them. I feel like you probably haven't checked them all out. I mean, there's just so many. And so you can do that. Maybe you're on a road trip. You're driving somewhere. Fill it up with theology. You can do that over at 1517.org/podcast. Also, while you're doing that, or while you're listening to this podcast, or while you're reading or watching something, you might be wondering, I just feel like it is at least as blessed to give than to receive. You might be thinking that. And you know, Jesus did say that it's actually more blessed. And so what you could do is you could partner up. You could go over to that donate page and you could join the crew. You can go over to Christ Old Fast, you can go over to 1517, either one, and you can go to the donate page and become a supporter. All of this stuff is made possible by a whole bunch of people doing a little. You could be one of them if you are able. And if you are someone who has done that, thank you very much. It is because of you that all of that stuff is able to exist. Eric, by the time this bad boy releases, we will be days away from Here We Still Stand. If you are listening to this, when it releases, you are right upon Here We Still Stand. And maybe you're one of the majority of people who was not able to come out for whatever reason. Maybe you waited too long and it sold out. Maybe it just wasn't, you couldn't make the trip happen. Whatever the reason, you can still be a part by going over to herewestillstand.org and you can register for the live stream and you can join us virtually. And it's going to be super legit. It costs you nothing. You just go over there and register for it. Name, email address, we'll send you a link, and you can join us virtually. Eric will talk to you from the stage. He'll acknowledge your existence. It'll be great.
What an honor.
What an honor. What an honor.
Yeah.
So, why not? I mean, even if you're like, well, I don't know if I'll have time, well, you know, it doesn't hurt you to register for it. You can register for it, and then if you're able to join in, when you're able to join in, do it. That way you don't have to wait the weeks that it takes us to edit all the videos and put them out there. You can just have them right there in that live stream. They'll live there too, so you'll be able to catch up later. Eric, what's going on in Acts right now?
Oh boy, well, we've got a lot going on in Acts. Last time we left off, end of Acts chapter 20, and we sort of had to, I mean, we didn't get to spend a ton of time, but it's a really sorrowful moment. It's actually a pretty difficult time because Paul is leaving the church in Ephesus that he has spent years with, that he has really helped to develop, and he knows where he's going. He is on his way to Jerusalem to bring an offering from all these different Gentile churches, and that he eventually knows the Spirit has revealed to him that he's eventually going to go to Rome and that he's not going to see them again. And so the whole of the last chapter was him basically leaving, preparing them for his departure. And so that's where we're at now in Acts 21. It says in verse 1, and when we had parted from them, notice the we again, that means Luke is writing from his own experience here. When we had parted from them and set sail, we came by a straight course to Kos, and the next day to Rhodes, and from there to Patara, not Pantera, Patara. And having found a ship crossing to Phoenicia, we went aboard and set sail. When we had come inside of Cyprus, leaving it on the left, we sailed to Syria and landed at Tyre, for there the ship was to unload its cargo. And having sought out the disciples, we stayed there for 7 days. And through the Spirit, they were telling Paul not to go on to Jerusalem. When our days there were ended, we departed and went on our journey, and they all with wives and children accompanied us until we were outside the city. And kneeling down on the beach, we prayed and said farewell to one another. And then we went on board the ship, and they returned home. So this is very briefly. We've got an instance here that might cause a little conflict if you were paying attention to the last chapter. If you go back to chapter 20, Paul says that the Holy Spirit has told him, has constrained him to go to Jerusalem and to bring this offering and then to go on to Rome. This is what he says throughout the chapter, in chapter 20, in his speech to the Ephesian church. But here, in the very beginning of chapter 21, you have, it appears, disciples in this town of Tyre, in this place of Tyre, saying, quote, through the Spirit, verse 4, that Paul shouldn't go on to Jerusalem. So how do we deal with this apparent contradiction between the Holy Spirit, say in chapter 20, and what apparently is going on here in chapter 21?
Well, it is a little rough. Just being real.
Yeah. I mean, well, it can be pretty difficult, I think, in trying to discern, how to interpret this. Did a little reading on this, thinking through it myself, and it is possible. You have to remember the Spirit is not capitalized in Greek, and that this could be referring to their own personal spirit, their own sort of sense of like, hey, we really feel that you shouldn't go on, but that this was not actually divinely revealed by the Spirit to them. They just knew that danger awaited, and so they didn't want him to go. Could be that, but still, it's a little rough.
It is. I think that there's a couple of options too. Is that it could be that they are, it's revealed to them via the Spirit that this is going to be dangerous and that something bad is going to happen, and then they are saying, "Hey, you shouldn't go because we feel like God is telling us that this is, this, that, and the other thing are going to happen," which is not the same as saying God told us you shouldn't go. But maybe God told us what was going to take place there, what potential things would happen there, and so therefore you really shouldn't go.
Right. So it's one thing to have the Spirit reveal something to them. It's a distinction to say, and this is how they interpreted it, what he should do as a result.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a tricky one. This kind of goes in. We hear Jesus say that he shows Paul all the things that he must suffer, which, for most people, if God was to show you something horrific that was going to happen, you might say, well, I just make sure not to go there.
Yeah.
You're like, well, God is showing me all the things I'm going to suffer, and so I'll just stay away from those things, because it's really
no,
good.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's really good of him to show me so I can avoid it. That's not how Paul looks at things like that, though.
No. Paul looks at things as, well, but where does the gospel need to go?
Right.
That's my calling. And this is not the only time that this kind of warning is going to happen. So if we move on to verse 7, it says, when we had finished the voyage from Tyre, we arrived at Ptolemy, and we greeted the brothers and stayed with them for one day. On the next day, we departed and came to Caesarea, and we entered the house of Philip the evangelist, who was one of the seven, and stayed with him. He had four unmarried daughters who prophesied. While we were staying for many days, a prophet named Agabus came down from Judea. By the way, he's referenced back in Acts chapter 11. And coming to us, he took Paul's belt and bound his own feet and hands and said, "Thus says the Holy Spirit, this is how the Jews at Jerusalem will bind the man who owns this belt and deliver him into the hands of the Gentiles." When we heard this, we and the people there urged him not to go up to Jerusalem. Then Paul answered, "What are you doing, weeping and breaking my heart? For I am ready not only to be imprisoned, but even to die in Jerusalem for the name of the Lord Jesus." And since he would not be persuaded, we ceased and said, "Let the will of the Lord be done."
Yeah, so this is the reason that I said that I think that you can have these people can have a revelation, which this guy obviously does, and maybe the people before. That's why I'm inferring that that things that could go badly, and that is revealed to them by God, and then, you know, in their humanness, they say, therefore, don't do it. But yeah, I don't believe
Luke.
Right, but I don't think this is God. I don't think that you should pull from this that God is telling Paul via these people not to do it, but more that God is telling Paul, he's preparing Paul for what could happen there through these people, and you know, and in their love for him, they are begging him not to go, and they're saying that you shouldn't go, mm-hmm. not go. So the knowledge of why the thing that is leading them to say you shouldn't go is brought about by the Spirit, but it's not as though the Spirit has told them to say, don't go. That's the best I can do with it.
Yeah, I think that's the best anyone can do with it. I think that makes the most sense of the text, because it is very clear throughout the entire Pauline narrative anyway, that the Spirit is driving him to get to Jerusalem. I mean, throughout all of his letters, it's very clear that Jerusalem is a major piece of where he's headed. I mean, he's so much of the offerings that he's taking, you know, that he mentions in his letters are all about Jerusalem. So it's not really possible to say, well, it just turns out that, you know, that wasn't really the case. It was a misinterpretation by Paul or something. No. This is where the Spirit's been leading him and guiding him from the beginning. And Paul says as much here. You know, what are you doing? Weeping and breaking my heart. So he actually almost in some ways has to rebuke them. Like, listen, you're making it harder for me to do this by your begging me to stay. Like, and if I can just read between the lines, it's like he's kind of saying, listen, I get it. Yes, I want to be comfortable too. I do. But prevent me from this desire to do whatever it takes to bring the gospel to people,
yeah,
and to serve our Lord Jesus. Don't tempt me.
And into, you know, to Luke's credit, I mean, also we do see that, you know, it'd be one thing if they were like, okay, well, have fun, and off he goes. But he doesn't go alone. People go, Luke goes with him, and others go with him as well. And so it doesn't ultimately dissuade them either.
Right. In fact, it probably gives them some courage, you know, to actually go on the way, that his willingness is there. And it just is, it is interesting. I mean, I love the fact that when it's all said and done, they say, let the will of the Lord be done.
Right.
And in the final analysis, there's going to be plenty of times in our life where we're forced into situations where we're called to do things that we might not want to do, or might be very uncomfortable, might even cause us pain. But we just have to go. There's nothing better to say than let the will of the Lord be done.
That's right.
So it says, after these days, verse 15, we got ready and went up to Jerusalem. And some of the disciples from Caesarea went with us, bringing us to the house of Mnason of Cyprus, an early disciple with whom we should lodge. When we had come to Jerusalem, the brothers received us gladly. On the following day, Paul went in with us to James, and all the elders were present. After greeting them, he related one by one the things that God had done among the Gentiles through his ministry. And when they heard it, they glorified God, and they said to him, you see, brother, how many thousands there are among the Jews of those who have believed? They are all zealous for the law, and they have been told about you that you teach all the Jews who are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, telling them not to circumcise their children or walk according to our customs. What then is to be done? They will certainly hear that you have come. Do therefore what we tell you. We have four men who are under a vow. Take these men and purify yourself along with them and pay their expenses so that they may shave their heads. Thus all will know that there is nothing in what they have been told about you, but that you yourself also live in observance of the law. But as for the Gentiles who have believed, we have sent a letter with our judgment that they should abstain from what has been sacrificed to idols, and from blood, and from what has been strangled, and from sexual immorality. Then Paul took the men, and the next day he purified himself along with them, and went into the temple, giving notice when the days of purification would be fulfilled and the offering presented for each one of them. Well,
I love and don't love this part.
Well, this is a tough part. Now, so let's tackle that. What's the difficult part here, Dan?
Well, the first thing is, like, of course he rolls in there and they're like, so we hear that you've been forsaking it's so common. Like, this is what happens. Like, oh, the gospel's going out. I hear that you've been preaching against Moses. Again, if you preach the gospel, what you'll be accused of is preaching against Moses. I mean, Jesus dealt with this a ton, and Paul deals with this. And they're like, you know, so.
And
like,
modern gospel preachers deal with this. Oh, this is always, always the accusation.
Absolutely. So, I mean, they're saying, hey, yeah, you're an antinomian. Like, or at least that's the word on the street.
That's what they're hearing. Yeah. That's word on the street is you're antinomos.
Yeah. And so,
anti-law.
Yeah. And so what ends up happening is they're like, so what we need to do is we need to quash that. So do this. And that way everyone will know that those things aren't true. And I don't love that he does it. And the reason I don't love it is because it's not about whether you do it or not. If Paul had, like, shown up and he had said to the people that were with him, hey, here's what we're going to do. Like, there's this reputation going around, so we're going to go and do this thing. Because, you know, that's the cultural norm, and like, that's what they expect, and like, we'll get out in front of it. But because it's being sort of compelled, it's, well, why are you doing this? What is this thing that you're doing? Maybe he just doesn't want to fight that battle right now, and that seems to be what it is. But it seems like he is being asked to do something that honestly that doesn't need to be done at all.
Yeah, this seems to me to be one of those times where Paul is willing to sacrifice for the comfort of his Jewish brethren in Jerusalem. You know, this is the stumbling block type issues that he talks about in both Romans and in his letter to the Corinthians, that in order to, I mean, I can see Paul's logic here. Like, I don't want to cause people to stumble over my presence here. So I'm going to show them that I'm okay with, you know, participating in these vows, even if I don't think they mean anything, even if I don't think that they're necessary. So I can see, I mean, if I'm looking at it best construction wise, I go, I get this. I get the impulse to, like, all right, you know, you want to try and, you know, be considerate. The problem I see with it is that I can see very easily how it can lead to confusion when you come to a letter of his, like Galatians, where literally he's like, if you allow circumcision, Christ is of no value to you. Like, where he's so strong and so harsh, I can see the early church going, wait, hold on, Paul. Like, here you said, like, we're free from all these things. We don't have to do any of them. But now I'm seeing you with this shaved head and you're doing all this stuff. How do you make sense of this? The only way I can make sense of it is Paul saying, I did it for the sake of peace for the time being.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, because what they bring up is like, yeah, people are murmuring and talking about how you don't tell them to circumcise their kids
I just want to hear one line in there is like, yeah, I don't.
Yeah, I want to hear
I'm telling them they don't have to.
I would have been like, darn right. That's what you're waiting for, because
yeah, that's the amazing power of the gospel.
I mean, that's the language he uses in his letters. It's just like, yeah,
like, yes,
absolutely, you don't have to do this. So yeah, it's again, this is. Shows you that that the church is complicated,
yeah,
and it's not all like it's not all straight and clean all the time, and yeah. So Paul does this for the sake of peace. And again, we're not necessarily privy to everything that is discussed here. We don't hear Paul's response. There's no, you know, I seriously doubt he said nothing.
Yeah,
it just moves on to say that he went along with it. But yeah, I think you're right that it's he's he's playing a long game here, and he's working for peace.
Yeah, that's. I think if you read into, you know, the narrative a little bit, it seems like, and considering Romans and 1 Corinthians and what he says about not being a stumbling block, it seems to me that's the most. It's the only way you can kind of read this. Want to point out that, like, initially, they seem to be pretty happy about his report, and that's a good thing. So, you know, there is no doubt tension. Like, there just is. And it's not an accident that Luke's account in Acts begins in Jerusalem and will end in Rome. Because the driving sort of force that we've seen all throughout the book of Acts is that Christianity is moving from being an entirely, almost entirely Jewish religion or Jewish sect to now becoming this Gentile movement. And so you see more and more the Jewish people rejecting the gospel and the Gentile Romans accepting the gospel. And moving on, that's indeed what we'll see. So as much as we would have hoped that Paul's extending a hand of, you know, a conciliatory hand may have helped him, it didn't with the Jews from Asia.
Yeah, the language I find it kind of humorous is the language that it uses when it says that, hey, there's a lot of Jews here that believed. And then it doesn't say, like, and they are zealous for the gospel. It's not. What they tell them is, like, listen, there's a lot of Jews here believed, and they are zealous for the law. And they have heard that you tell these Gentiles to forsake Moses, not circumcise their kids, and not walk according to our customs, which is all true.
Yes, that's, yes,
that is absolutely the case. You know, not forsake Moses in the sense of completely forsake the law, but forsake it for righteousness.
Yes, correct. I mean, completely. This is a really difficult. I mean, so this is why. Listen, I mean, to use your phrase, Dan, the church is not all roses and bubblegum.
Right.
And you know, there's in every church, you're going to have dynamics like this, where it's like, well, you know, we've got to try and work with this group over here. To make, you know, we don't want to isolate these people for the sake of this group. I mean, that kind of thing still happens very, very often. And, you know, when you're a pastor, as Paul indeed is, like, you have to think through how to best handle very difficult and complicated issues.
Yeah. And so I definitely think that Paul is, sometimes you give a little bit so that you can be heard.
Yeah. I think you have to do that. So this seems to be one of those instances. But it doesn't result in much peace for him, because it says when the 7 days were almost completed, verse 27, the Jews from Asia, seeing him in the temple, stirred up the whole crowd and laid hands on him, crying out, "Men of Israel, help. This is the man who is teaching everyone everywhere against the people and the law and this place. Moreover, he even brought Greeks into the temple and has defiled this holy place."
This is what happens when you're zealous for the law, by the way.
So this is the zeal for this is they are zealous for Moses, and so that leads to them persecuting Paul. Verse 29, for they had previously seen Trophimus the Ephesian with him in the city, and they supposed that Paul had brought him into the temple. Then all the city was stirred up, and the people ran together. They seized Paul and dragged him out of the temple, and at once the gates were shut, and as they were seeking to kill him, word came to the tribune of the cohort that all Jerusalem was in confusion. He at once took soldiers and centurions and ran down to them. And when they saw the tribune and the soldiers, they stopped beating Paul. Then the tribune came up and arrested him and ordered him to be bound with two chains. He inquired who he was and what he had done. Some in the crowd were shouting one thing, some another. And as he could not learn the facts because of the uproar, he ordered him to be brought into the barracks. And when he came to the steps, he was actually carried by the soldiers because of the violence of the crowd, for the mob of the people followed, crying out, "Away with him!" Well, so much for the conciliatory act on his part.
Yeah, that's doesn't work. And this is what's nuts about this is you have a bunch of guys that are like, Like, I can't, but this guy doesn't want to keep the law. Let's kill him.
Yeah.
And this is what.
Let's break the law.
Yeah, this is what happens when you decide to do that. I mean, this is Paul.
Oh, man.
Paul knows all about this. Paul says, like, I was so zealous for the law that I broke the law trying to keep the law.
It is a guarantee that it leads here. Always. Always. Legalism always goes here. And that's what this is. I mean, this is legalism's end result. It ends in wanting to kill any voice that says you're free from the law's demands.
Right.
I mean, you just can't handle it. I mean, and this is really, I mean, we've run into mobs. I mean, in Ephesus, you had, you know, the mob that we talked about last week, and just sort of the demagogic way that they dealt with it when he was preaching there. But here again is another mob, and they're just, I mean, it's so unattractive, you know, when you see it, but they're just, I mean, they're presented like animals here by Luke. I mean,
yeah,
the soldiers have to carry him, you know, because they, you know, against the, away from the people, because the people are so intent on killing him. So verse 37, as Paul was about to be brought into the barracks, he said to the tribune, "May I say something to you?" And he said, "Do you know Greek? Are you not the Egyptian then who recently stirred up a revolt and led the 4,000 men of the assassins out into the wilderness?" Paul replied, "I am a Jew from Tarsus in Cilicia, a citizen of no obscure city. I beg you, permit me to speak to the people." And when he had given him permission, Paul, standing on the steps, motioned with his hand to the people. And when there was a great hush, he addressed them in the Hebrew language, saying, "Brothers and fathers, hear the defense that I now make before you." And when they heard that he was addressing them in the Hebrew language, they became even more quiet. Now, it's interesting. I think this is another give and take sort of thing. He decides that he's going to address them in Hebrew because that is what he's showing his own credentials, right?
Right.
And so this is what this sort of sets up the next podcast, because we don't have time to go into his whole defense of his ministry. But it just shows that Paul, from the very beginning to the very end, is always trying whatever means possible to reach his Jewish brethren. Always, constantly doing whatever is necessary to try and show them why his belief in Jesus as their Messiah and as his Messiah is in fact true. And so this is the beginning of his first defense. He'll do it a few more times as we get to the close of the book of Acts.
Yeah, yeah. So he's going to address them in Hebrew. He's going to tell his story. We'll see how that goes. I think you can probably guess how that goes. But a quick note, I do think it's really funny. They have this weird thing like, "Hey, are you not this this one dude who like led like a couple thousand people out into the wilderness?" Like, that's a weird insertion in there, right?
So, well, what does that tell you?
Oh, that tells you that, I mean, this place was going nuts, and they thought this guy must have been like someone really dangerous and bad.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and frankly, Josephus actually talks of this group, the assassins, otherwise known as daggermen. It's literally in Greek, it's sicarios, which I don't know if you're familiar with the movie Sicario, you know, the hitmen, the movie about hitmen for the drug cartels and stuff. But basically what they do with Roman sympathizers is they would stab them under the cover of crowds. So they would like slip into a crowd, and any Roman sympathizer in the crowd, they'd stab them with that and then just slip away. So this was what was being referred to here.
Yeah, so they thought like, this must be the guy.
Yeah, we caught him. Turns out he's way more boring than that.
Yeah, he's not, nothing to do with that. What a weird little thing. But a thing that like brings some historicity to the text.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, this is something, again, Luke knows the people reading this would be familiar with, and that's why he brings it up.
Yeah. Well, next week, guys, we will hear Paul's appeal to his fellow Jews. In the meantime, while you wait, go over to that Here We Still Stand and register for that live stream, because you could hear a bunch of stuff between now and the next podcast. You could be hearing a lot of stuff. You won't be hearing Paul talk, but you could be hearing some other people talk about probably some stuff that Paul said. So go over there, register. We'd love to see you. Eric, I will see you this weekend.
Sounds good.